Hi, so today's podcast runs a little long. We talk a lot about Uluru and the Aboriginal people and the culture and just everything about it. So it runs a little long, but stick with us. We talk a lot and hopefully you learn something because we learned a lot about going to Uluru and doing this podcast. So every episode won't be this long, but this just we had to get through a lot and there's so much that we couldn't cut it. So here we go.
Hi, I'm Leah Canland with my husband Steve, and you're listening to our Insightful Adventures, a show that chronicles our travels around Australia and the savvy, scientific, and scenic things we experience along the way.
So this episode, we were traveling through the red heart of Australia, or the red center of Australia. And we started in Wyclough Well and went from there to Alice Springs, which was 375 kilometers, or 225 miles. From Alice Springs to Uluru Kadajuda National Park, 461 kilometers, 277 miles. We drove around Uluru Kadajuda National Park for 2.5 days, and so drove around another 243 kilometers, 146 miles. From Uluru to Wataka National Park, or Kings Canyon, and from there to there was 251 kilometers, 151 miles. And then from there to the Northern Territory, South Australia border. So we did a total of 2,120 kilometers, 1,272 miles, and we did that in 4.5 days through the Red Heart.
So today's episode begins in Alice Springs, and we were only in Alice Springs for that evening because we were really anxious to go to Uluru the next day. And so the only thing we had time to do in Alice Springs is have a big, delicious meal at the Overlanders Steakhouse.
It was delicious. It was an experience to have this meal. So they gave us meat of crocodile meat.
So we had the Drover's Blowout.
The Drover's Blowout.
Yes, which we had heard that in Alice Springs, at one of the bars, they have all sorts of exotic Australian meats that you can try. And from what we could find, the Drover's Blowout at the Overlander Steakhouse is probably what they were talking about. And so they did have a platter consisting of 5 different kinds of exotic Australian meat.
Five exotic Australian meat. So crocodile. You might have to tell me with all of it. Crocodile,
kangaroo,
yep. Buffalo, right?
Uh-huh. And camel. Oh, maybe there's only 4. Crocodile, kangaroo, buffalo, and camel.
Camel, yes. And so it was pretty small pieces of meat for all 4 of them, but they were pretty good.
Yeah, so yeah, it was just a sampling platter. This Drover's Blowout comes with a soup, and then it has the tasting platter, and then it has your main course, and then it has your dessert. So it's sort of this, you know, several course meal thing, but really we just cared about those different little patties of meat. And I gotta say, crocodile was not that good.
No, it was just kind of chewy. I was gonna say squishy, but it was just chewy.
Yeah.
So you don't really have crocodile for the meat. It was just this tourist thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was pretty much the only thing worth mentioning in Alice Springs.
But buffalo was pretty good. I like the buffalo.
Yeah, Steve liked the buffalo. And then the next morning, we drove into the Uluru Kadajuda National Park.
When we first got there the first day, it was too hot to do anything. So it seems to be a fairly common practice that if it gets too hot, they just close the hikes and they don't let anyone go on them because they have a fear of dehydration and heat stroke.
Yeah, like literally too hot to do anything. Like not like, oh, we were too tired, but like you are not allowed to hike past 7 a.m., 9 a.m.?
No, it depends on the temperature. So anytime past like 9 to 11 a.m., anytime it hits over 36 degrees Celsius, they close the trail and will give you a fine if they find you hiking after that.
Yeah.
So we didn't do anything that first day. The second day, we saw a sunrise over Katajuda and Uthuru, which again was just so epic, so awesome. And then we hiked around Katajuda, and...
Yeah, so there's like a big hike to do in Katajuda called Valley of the Winds. And it's 7.4 kilometers.
Yeah.
I think it's a little over maybe 4.5 miles. And there are two lookouts that you can hike to. But one, it's so touristy in the center. There's just tour bus after tour bus, which is something that we've been lucky enough not to have to experience. And so it was so touristy. And really, the Valley of the Winds hike, we weren't that impressed with.
No, it was just, we did it. So after sunrise, we got to the hike at like 7 a.m. or something. And it was just still just so hot. It wasn't worth it, really, the hike.
But if you do want to do the hike, we recommend doing it in reverse.
Yeah. So you go in, instead of going clockwise like we did, go counterclockwise. And we reckon that's a little bit, would be better.
Yeah. And it's not that Katajuda is just amazingly gorgeous as well. It's just that I appreciated it way more from a distance, from the whole view, than I did actually in the canyon. So that's my two cents.
And I agree. So I guess we're going to talk about Kings Canyon before we hit Uthuru, just because we want to focus a lot of our time on Uthuru and end on Uthuru. So we actually did Kings Canyon after Uthuru, but we're just going to mention it now. And that is a little ways outside of Uthuru, and it's just another national park. And again, we got there late one night, and we just did a small hike. And then the next morning, we did the big, like, rim hike all the way around.
Yeah. And as far as all the hikes that we did in the Red Center, I would say that the canyon rim walk at Wataka or Kings Canyon was my favorite. It was amazing. It was beautiful. I loved that hike.
It was super, super pretty.
And one of the main features of the Kings Canyon rim hike are these sandstone domes that have formed over the years. And when Steve and I were in Western Australia, there's a national park called it's Pernalulu National Park. And inside Pernalulu, there's bungalows on Piccadilly Creek, which I just had to say all those fun words. So the bungalows are similar formations to what we saw at Wataka. And I was really excited to see those because the national park was closed whenever we tried to go to bungalows. So there's this awesome, like, beehive shaped domes, and the traditional owners of Wataka, they're called the Luritja people, and Wataka is a really important ceremonial place for them, and they associate the Korninka dreaming with that site. And so Korninka is the western qual. And I feel like I have to just like interpret on so many levels. So a qual is this like marsupial cat thing that they have in Australia. Yeah. So it's
everything
dream.
In Australia is this marsupial something.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a qual dreaming site. And they say that these domes on the canyon are the young qual men or the young Korninka men.
Yeah. Anyways, it was a really pretty hike, and it was still fairly touristy when we did it, but that didn't distract from the beauty.
No, it was still amazing. Totally recommend it. Still the most beautiful hike that I did in the center of Western Australia.
And it was a pretty long hike, but it was pretty and definitely worth doing.
Oh, every single part of the hike was beautiful. And I will say that we didn't go to the what is it, the West McDonald National Park? There's another national park we didn't get to. That's probably gorgeous. We just didn't get there. So that's why Kings Canyon wins my vote for best hike.
The best hike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and then we'll go back in time and talk where we did Uluru. Okay, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Uluru. But we have some backup information, some history to kind of to go over before we kind of get into Uluru. And so let's just get into it.
Yeah, so this was just a really great learning experience for Steve and I. We wanted to be as well informed as we could about the Aboriginal people in a general sense, but also the specific traditional owners of Uluru. And so a lot of the information that we're going to be sharing is either stuff that we learned from the park ranger at Uluru or from the plaques they have around, or I was lucky enough to find a tour operator workbook of Uluru National Park. And so this is the training manual that the tour operators have to use. And so that's where this information is coming from. And so some of the things that are important to have this base level of understanding is that there are several Aboriginal cultures. Uluru, since it's more inland and it has a lot of thick shrubs and it's in the western desert with just occasional water holes, that environment really shapes how their food is obtained, and that in turn shapes their entire, a large element of their culture, because they're hunter-gatherers, and so they have, they want to minimize the amount of things they carry around, and so they have these cool adaptations where their tools and weapons will have multiple uses, and also the fact that they do live in these harsh conditions. Their movements are very, very seasonal, and they revolve around this availability of food and water at different places and at different times of the year. As far as an Aboriginal language, what's interesting is that prior to the European contact, linguistics think that there were about 250 Aboriginal languages. And within those languages, about 700 dialects.
Oh, yeah. And I was just going to say, so one of the distinctions that we want to make is I made the mistake, I think oftentimes and still do, I compare Aboriginal people to Native Americans. And they're quite different. The biggest similarities are really how Westerners just
treated them.
Yeah. That's where the similarities come in. But before that, really nothing. So Aboriginal people didn't necessarily dwell in what we as Americans would call tribes for Native Americans. They essentially were separated by language groups almost, and what Leah was describing. And what we really learned is it wasn't you're one group against one other group. It was just they really traded with each other, and oftentimes you would, if you married, you'd marry with another group, and they had this super complex, and we'll get into it, super complex.
Oh, I can't get into it. It's way too complex for me.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we'll just like of how you would marry and who you could marry, and we'll get into more of their norms and culture and stuff in a minute, but just so it wasn't like one people against another, one group against another. You often traded and traveled through your lands, and like they said, over 250 different languages, and then subgrouped into so many different dialects. And yeah,
and around Uluru there's about four different dialects that are spoken, and linguists sort of call that the Western Desert language.
And just as another point of clarification, a dialect is a mutually understandable language. So it can be different in some forms, like English spoken here in Australia is a different dialect of English, as an example, and American English is another one.
Yeah. Some other important things to point out, or at least in our effort to try to be politically correct, the words, terminology to avoid when talking about Aboriginal people is to avoid saying that someone is part Aboriginal, because that doesn't make sense to them. They're like, well, what part of me, like my arm or my leg? Avoid calling Aboriginal people black or people of color. And so even though those are terms for the most part, so those were derived from the American civil rights debates, and they might be considered correct in America, but for Aboriginal people, those are not the preferred terminology. And even just calling somebody an Aborigine, urbanized Aboriginal people find it sort of patronizing. And so the best form, the best terminology, I guess, to use is to call someone an Aboriginal person or Aboriginal people. But what's even preferred more than that is to actually use the terms that they use themselves. And so in Perth, in the Perth region where we're from, in the southwest of Australia, that is the Noongar people. And here in Uluru, in this region, the traditional owners refer to themselves as the Anangu. Or you can refer to them by their language group, which is the Pitjantjatjara people. But either way, we are going to be referring to the people, the Aboriginal people, as the Anangu.
Yeah, well, we're talking more about here in Uluru.
Yeah.
And so, do you have any more? That's just kind of a some history, some PC terms on the Aboriginal people, and that was really important for us to know and understand. And as we continue to explore Uluru, to really understand the Aboriginal people and their culture, there's anthropological evidence that they had been in the area around Uluru for over 22,000 years. And there's evidence in Australia in general that Aboriginal people had been there for over 50,000 years.
Yeah.
So they had seen the last ice age before and after. These people are probably, if not the oldest, one of the oldest living peoples on Earth.
Yeah, I've heard that it's the oldest living culture on Earth.
Which is just crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So now we want to get into Uluru, and the most important way to understand Uluru is to understand, what they call Jukupa.
Yes. And we're probably mispronouncing with the Jukupa.
No, that's how you say it.
Jukupa?
Jukupa.
Jukupa.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has a good definition, but it entails everything about their lives. It entails creation. It deals with their laws and not necessarily punishments, but when you break a law, what happens? And it entails their norms, the social norms, the social mores, how they interact, who you can marry, economics, the government.
Yeah. So essentially, it's their worldview. And so sometimes in other Aboriginal cultures, in a lot of the Aboriginal cultures that we have learned about on our travels, they have a dream time or dreaming, you know, and that's their story. And Jukupa has been incorrectly translated to be dreaming, but it's even more than a dream time story. It is what Steve was saying. It's their worldview. It's their economy, their environment, the science, their nuclear family, their religious values, their power structure, how they trade. It is their absolute worldview.
Yeah, it entails a lot. And not that we even really understand any of it, really. We tried to scrap the surface, but we're going to refer to the Jukupa a lot in the next little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is what our time was spent in Uluru, was learning different elements of the Jukupa, different stories. And since it is an oral tradition, the Jukupa is learned and passed down through songs and dance, which is, you know, these different rituals, and it encompasses every single aspect of of the Anangu people's lives and worldview.
Yeah, super fascinating. And so a lot of this, the Jukupa story entails Uluru, how Uluru was created, how the ancient ancestor creator beings created Uluru, kind of the stories around it, some of the ceremonies that they still do to this day, not necessarily at these specific sites over Uluru, but still participate in. We're going to go through a couple different stories of, according to the Jukupa, how Uluru was created and why Uluru is important to them.
Yeah, so the most, well, no, there. So the first story that we're going to go through is the Mala Jukupa, and Mala is the rufous hair wallaby, and the Anangu people derived from or came from these Mala people. And so the Mala Jukupa is that these Mala, or rufous hair wallabies, they came to Uluru from the north and the west, and they came for an important men's ceremony at Uluru. And the Mala men started by decorating a ceremonial pole, and a group of the senior men climbed to the top of Uluru and planted the pole at its highest point. And at Uluru, you can actually see what the you can see this the ceremonial pole. You can see what they say is a ceremonial pole. It's this rock leaning against Uluru, and so the women, in the meantime, were gathering enough food for everybody, and they had prepared and stored all the food in these other caves, which are part of the Uluru rock face. And not long after the ceremony began, there was an invitation that came from some Wintaka men. And these Wintaka men came from the west, and they invited the Mala men to attend their ceremonies. But as a rule of thumb, once a ceremony has begun, it has to be completed without being interrupted. And so the Mala men had to turn down the invitation. But because they refused the invitation, the Wintaka men became really angry, and they used a powerful magic to construct an evil monster that they called the Krumpani. And the Krumpani is just this monster dog-like creature. And so this Krumpani was sent to wreak havoc on this Mala ceremony. And so the Mala women, so the men and women are separated during the ceremony. And so the Mala women, they were camped for the night, and they didn't hear the monster coming. But at the last second, the kingfisher woman, she screamed out a warning just in time, and all the women fled into the ceremony. And the arrival of the women just ruined the ceremony, and the monster attacked two Mala men and devoured them. And then in all of that confusion, the Mala men and women, they fled just hundreds of kilometers to the south, and this monster was still coming after them. And they say that kingfisher woman still keeps watch at Uluru, but she's now this large rock. And you can also see the monster's footprints on one part of Uluru. And you can see where the Mala men were attacked by the monster in Uluru as well.
Yeah, so that's just... And that story teaches or conveys the thought that ceremony needs to continue. But if you get invited by another group to participate in their ceremony, it's understood that if you're not in ceremony already yourselves, you're obligated to go. If you are in ceremony and you get invited, it's understood that you can decline, but only because you're in ceremony. So it's kind of this way of how to interact between different groups. If you get invited to ceremony, you can or can't, according to if you're in ceremony or not.
Yeah, and I think it's just another great example of this Jukupa explains the Mala people. It explains the kingfisher people, and the Wintaka is the mulga seed, so it explains mulga seed. And with each of these different occurrences in the story, that you can see the evidence of that happening in the rock face itself. And so what I didn't realize before we came to Uluru, I just thought it was this big rock that as a whole was very important and sacred. But after being there and learning all these different Jukupa stories, I now understand that each cave, each scratch, each hole, each divot in the rock, it means something. It tells a story. It teaches a lesson. It proves that their ancestors, you know, were here and thriving, and it's just something that I didn't realize before.
Yeah, and I thought the same thing, because I had heard before we got there that the traditional owners consider Uluru a sacred site. I didn't really understand why. Not that I really do now, but just that everything on the rock, like Leah said, means something, and it's a story, and it's a way to do ceremony. And they still don't share everything about these sites or about the stories with quote-unquote Westerners, because a lot of these stories on these sites are still really sacred to them, still really part of their culture. And you have to be initiated, you have to be, some of the things that they go through are only for women or for men, and you have to be in their culture and be a part of it to really learn about it. Because they don't want to just throw their culture in front of Westerners and it gets misinterpreted or it's hard to understand. And I mean, I get it, right? How do you explain 22,000 years of history to a Westerner that doesn't get it at all? So yeah, this whole rock, every little thing about it means and says something.
Yeah. And something else that I understand better now also is just how important gender roles are. It's something that I knew existed with other Aboriginal people, like with the Bardi and Jawa Rangers over up in Broome at One Arm Point, which is in Western Australia. There were definite gender roles for male and female park rangers. And here at Uluru, just with understanding the Jukupa, there's definite male and female roles, and there's sacred ceremonies that female have, that the women have, and that the men have. And
it's not in any power struggle. It's not in the sense that I think of, like, oh, gender roles, like men over women. It's just they have a separate roles for each gender. And it's they really don't have any, like, power struggles within their groups or within their people. It's just, in according to their Jukupa, men do these type of things, women do these type of things, and together it makes up the whole. Like, if
yeah, and I think that it might have stemmed out of necessity, because they're hunter-gatherer people, you know, and so it just makes sense to me that if it's a living culture, and yeah, it just the whole gender role thing is so ingrained in their culture, in their Jukupa, and they're
respectful of the other.
Yes. So true. Yeah, they're sacred women's sites. So you're allowed to go on what's called a mala walk, and mala should be a familiar term now, because that means the roughest hair wallaby. So you go on a mala walk, and if you go, they have a ranger-led mala walk every day at like 8 a.m.
8 a.m.
Yeah, which we highly recommend doing. And we had a male ranger. And on this mala walk, it's once you learn the stories and let the gravity of the Jukupa sort of sink in, and you walk around the mala sites, and you have them, and you realize that they're like these sacred women sites and sacred men sites that the Anangu people have allowed people to walk by. All they ask is that you don't take photography or video at these sites. It's amazingly generous that they would open up. I don't know how much of a choice they necessarily had going into it at first, but the fact that they do allow people to see these sites, even if you're not allowed to photograph them, is very, very welcoming.
Yeah, and we'll get into kind of a little bit later the reasons of why we ended up deciding not to climb the rock. But really, the Anangu people, they want people to come and learn about them, learn about the Uluru, listen, like learn about everything. They just want to educate people on how important this is to them, and they want to educate people about who they are.
So another important ancestral being to be introduced to is Kunia, who is a woman python. And a Jukupa story about Kunia is that she came far away in the east, traveled from the east to hatch her children at Uluru. And there's a few different sites at Uluru where she left her eggs and another site where she made a camp. But one day Kunia had... So Kunia had a nephew who did something very grievous to the Liru people, and Liru is the poisonous snakes. And so Kunia's nephew did something so grievous that they don't even share what he did. But Kunia was in a lot of trouble, and he ran away from his punishment. And Kunia, the woman python, just saw that there were Liru people chasing him. And the Liru people rushed upon him when he was resting at Uluru, and they hurled their spears at him. And there are a lot of spears that hit the rock face with so much force that they pierced it. And you can still see to this day these round holes which are in the side of Uluru. And unfortunately, this nephew, this Kunia nephew, he died, and he was speared. And so when the news of the nephew's death reached the aunt, Kunia, she was so angry and so sad. She raced along the curves of the rock, and she confronted one of the Liru warriors, who just mocked her grief and her rage. And Kunia began to dance a dance of immense power and magic. And as she moved towards the Liru warrior, she was spitting poison, which to this day still has poisoned these fig trees and spear vines that are close to this site of Uluru that the Anangu people know to avoid eating. And she took her digging stick and she pounded it into the head of the Liru, which she just actually intended to only inscribe him with the quote sorry cut that Anangu still inflict on themselves when there's a death of a loved one. But because she was so angry and so sad, she hit this Liru again across the head, and he died. And so what we learn from this after this Liru died, she did a special ceremony, and she combined her spirit with the spirit of her dead nephew, and they together became Wanampi, which is the rainbow serpent who still lives and protects this water hole where this took place at Uluru. And really what this Jukupa story about Kunia teaches is this traditional form of payback punishment. And a spear to the thigh, which is what these Liru poisonous snakes were trying to inflict on the nephew, which is a fair and just punishment, this nephew ran away from. And what's interesting is that if you're the one that was wronged and you're entitled to a payback punishment, once you throw somebody... or once you spear somebody in the thigh, you have to look after the injured person until they're well enough to take care of themselves. And this story also teaches about a woman's intuition, and that a woman is allowed to use force to protect her children, basically. So it's a story about this amazingly powerful Kunia python woman.
Yeah, and that's such a cool story. And these are just two of the Jukupa stories that we heard. And there's so many more that we aren't even aware of. And these stories tell, again, just about the creation, about how to deal with other groups, how to deal within their own group. It deals with so much and is so deep. And there's just so much there that it's really, I mean, we don't even understand. And it's I think it's really cool to know that they have this such deep culture and understanding and way of living. I mean, I just find the things just so fascinating. They didn't war with each other. They didn't, because if they war with each other, then that impeded their survival. It wasn't like, oh, over here, they have a lot of water, and so we're going to go and kill them all so we'll have all the water. They didn't think like that. If they had a grievance with another group, they would go and take care of the grievance and then leave.
But in such a respectful way, it's amazing. They would send just one teenage boy, basically, that would approach. Since these are hunter-gatherers, they don't have permanent shelters. And so this little messenger boy from a neighboring people would approach a few, 100, 200 meters from the camp they were set at. And he would just sit down on the ground with his back to the camp and wait for him to be invited. And so he would state the business, and then it would just be settled, a specific grievance with a specific person would be settled with a specific person for that specific grievance. And it never, not that we know, but it just sounds like, there weren't these wars, because not only it impeded your survival because they had such a complex marrying system and just a complex family. If you fought a neighboring people, then you would be fighting against your own relatives and your own family.
Yeah, a lot of the time. And not just that, since they were hunter-gatherers, they were always on the move. And in this area, what drove their movement was mostly water. And so they had moved to according to where they knew where water was. And all the stories of all the other groups and languages kind of mixed together, and they all knew each other's language or stories. So if they were traveling through and they were kind of maybe outside their normal little area a little bit, but they knew they were in someone else's area, they knew their stories, then they could say, okay, over here, this happened, and so we know we're going to find food or water over there. And they traded with each other and did ceremonies with each other. And that way, when they ran out of water in one area, they could travel to another and vice versa. And I mean, as far as we understand, they didn't ever fight each other to annihilation or for conquest or for prize or for money. It was just grievance for grievance, and it was taken care of, and then it was forgotten and they moved on.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, to me, the sign of a very sophisticated culture, and something that in every other part of the world, for America, at least, that is definitely not the mentality. And I just have so much respect for a culture that doesn't even have the rules of war built into their complex culture. This explains everything. The Jugupa explains how every single creation came to be. We're talking every single species of bird, every single species of plant, every single water hole, whether it's permanent or temporary. The Jugupa explains
eat, what you
that
can't, and
who
what
you
order
marry.
You eat.
Yeah, yeah, like ceremonial practices, and the fact that they don't have, I don't know.
I mean, just the fact that they'd have been around for this people for 22,000 years. I can't even trace my ancestry back more than a couple hundred years, right? They had been around longer than maybe anyone else on the entire planet. They had to have gotten something right.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. On the Mala Walk, another feature that you can see in that part of Uluru's rock face is a cave. And the cave, perhaps, I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but it's Kopin Yinki Kaku. Anyways,
okay.
there's a cave, one of the caves that you can see on the Mala Walk. And what's cool about this cave is that it has rock art on the wall. And at this cave, the Anangu elders taught boys how to travel in the country and survive, just the things that we were talking about. So these boys were taken from their parents and taken from their family, and it was the grandparents teaching the grandchildren. And they would paint pictures on the cave wall similar probably to how people, you know, draw on a blackboard or chalkboard to sort of teach things. And so on this wall, they would be taught how to track and to hunt. And then the grandchildren would be taken out in the bush and they'd learn about the country. They'd learn where the water holes are, where the animals are, where the materials used for making tools and weapons are. And this learning lasted several years. I mean, we heard one woman asking the guide, how old were they and how long did it last? And she was saying, I mean, the guide was saying, what, 12-year-olds, 16-year-olds?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't really keep track of, like, years as we do. And so they just... pretty much from puberty,
boys.
And that was your way of becoming a man and being a man in the community, in the group.
Yeah, and so until they proved their hunting skills and their self-reliance and their discipline, they were taught by their elders.
Yeah, and they have so much respect for their elders in Aboriginal culture.
Yes, yeah, it's considered rude to stare at...
An elder,
which, I mean, of course, it's rude to stare in a lot of cultures, but even just like how a grandchild might stare at their grandparent or whatever, you know, not in a rude way, but just sort of intently look at them for a while, that's considered rude. And it's really, they say that like, elders, they don't need to like dye their hair or hide their age because it's nothing to be ashamed about. It's something to be proud of because they're very respected when they're older.
Yeah. Anyways, there's just so much about this culture and about Uluru that's just so fascinating. And that kind of leads us to kind of our last little thought that we're going to share with you, which is why we decided not to climb. So years ago, you could... climb the rock, and it was the big tourist thing to do, is you could climb Uluru or Ayers Rock, and you could get a certificate that said I climbed the world's biggest rock or whatever. And now they're making a push to not do it, and we decided not to do it for a lot of different reasons. I don't know, do you want to go first or should I go first?
You can go first, because I'll probably just say yes and I agree.
So we decided not to do it for a lot of different reasons, and I'll try to be brief. But essentially, so the Jukapa entails everything, right? And I can kind of grasp simple concepts. I can grasp that, okay, you have laws and punishments to those laws. Okay, the same as me. You have norms and mores and social consequences, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially, the Aboriginal people, the Anangu, ask you not to climb the rock because it's sacred. And we just learned that it's not just sacred in one way. It's sacred in so many different ways, ways that we're not even aware of. And if this people had been around for 22,000 years and they say, please come to Uluru, learn about us, learn about what it is, and listen and just come and experience it, but please don't climb. And they just say, please don't climb because it's a sacred site. And I get it. It's just so hard for them to explain. You can't explain a whole history to a Western person who just comes from a different culture. And it's just near impossible for me to look through their glasses, their culture, and their worldview. And for them to simply say, come and learn, but please don't do that. I just decided that I'm going to respect that. Even if I don't completely understand why, I don't need to. I just need to know that it's important to them. And I still got to experience Uluru. I don't feel like I got left out in any way. And I definitely have a deeper understanding of these people and who they are and what they did and what they continue to do. And I think that's great. And I learned a lot. And yeah, so I decided not to climb it.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to bring up too that, you know, Steve and I will never understand certain sacred sites and why they are sacred and even where some of these sacred sites are. But there are some sites, until you're initiated, even within that culture, you don't know it either. You know, there's some women's sites and women's ceremonies that men will never know what happens. And same with men's sacred sites and men's ceremonies, women won't know what it looks like or what the ceremonies entail. And so perhaps from their point of view, whenever Westerners say, well, we don't understand why we can't climb it, you know, I don't know how much that really phases them. They're like, well, there's aspects of our culture that we don't know either, you know, but that's not ours to know.
Yeah. And then the other thing too is to climb it is a very Western thought. To climb something, to conquer it, to get above it, to say that you did it is a very Westerner mentality. And that wasn't their mentality at all. And I felt like a visitor. I feel like, I mean, I am a visitor here to Australia, but a visitor to the traditional people. And I didn't want to have the mentality of, yes, I did it, I conquered. Because that's, I didn't want to have that connotation or to do that. Because I can't conquer either. I can't conquer the people, nor do I even want to symbolically try.
Yeah. So there are three reasons why the park asks you not to climb. They say it's for safety reasons. They say, and safety reasons being that it actually is a pretty tricky scramble to even get to the handrails, and the handrails are just awkwardly low, like around your knees, and you're bent over trying to go up this single rail, and then it gets hot and slippery, and then there's no facilities at the top, and so you have to, if you have to do your business, it has to be on there. Anyway, so there's definitely safety reasons that go into it, and then there's environmental reasons that the park also states. You can see this scar left on the rock of just thousands of people throughout the years that have trodden up this handrail path, and so it's sort of weathering the rock irregularly. And then when I said about the human waste, whenever it does rain and it rains and it falls into these, you know, sometimes permanent water holes or temporary water holes, which are really important to the wildlife there. So the environmental reason definitely was a compelling one, but ultimately it's that cultural reason that Steve was talking about that I also decided not to climb Uluru. And for me, I did a lot of research. Steve and I talked about this for months and months, if we were going to climb it or not. But the longer we were at Uluru and the more that I learned, I wanted to show my respect by not climbing the rock. And for me, I felt like I was being respectful by not climbing the rock. And I don't want to accuse anybody of being disrespectful if they do decide to climb the rock, because there were still plenty of people that wanted to climb the rock. And we met an Australian couple that would have climbed if it was weather permitting, because since they are Australian, they feel like, well, this is our rock, you know, like they say it's their rock, but it's our rock too, because we're Australian, and they felt very entitled to be able to climb it, and were disappointed when they couldn't. But for me, I understand that there are sacred things and important things, and even if to an outsider what you hold to be sacred is just looks like a rock, or maybe it just looks like, you know, the sacrament or communion is just a piece of bread, you know, but it means so much more to some people that are Christian, you know. So I definitely can sort of understand how something that doesn't seem special or sacred actually has deep meaning. And since I am a religious person, I can understand someone else's viewpoint that this is sacred, and please respect what I find sacred.
So normally at the end of our episode, we share an insight and adventure, but this episode is already kind of long. So I think we'll just kind of end it there, because I think that's definitely a lot of insight already packed into that episode. So thanks for listening. Catch us on Instagram @insightfuladventures. And that's a great place to see photos that we've posted and to connect with us, ask us questions. There's just so much that we experienced here that we can't talk about everything, but we thank you for listening.
And if you have any follow-up questions at all, like Steve said, there's so much information that we have that we can't even share in the podcast. So shoot us questions on Instagram and we will do our best to answer them.